Hello and welcome to the How They Did It Business Podcast, where we share stories from the best in business. I'm your host, Alec Taylor, the founder of Diverse VC. Today, we have Mariah Lichtenstein, the founding partner of Diversity Ventures, which offers advisory services to pre-seed companies and targets investments in early stage companies. Both Mariah and Diversity Ventures believe that innovation thrives where diverse perspectives intersect. And they capitalize on those intersections by backing companies that are creating positive social, economic, and environmental impact. She's an alumna of UC Berkeley, USC, and UCLA. Mariah serves as the managing director of the Founding Institute, is a member of UCLA Ventures, and an advisor for CalSeed Clean Tech Fund, and more. Mariah, welcome. So excited to have you on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Alec. I'm excited to be here.
I love it. And I know you are tremendously busy and you're doing so many amazing things for the community. So I'd love to hop into our fire round and ask you a couple of fun and funky questions. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Perfect. One of my favorite questions is asking about books. I think they change the mindsets and the perspectives of so many people and they can offer so much. But I put a fun twist on it. It's about what books you like to gift people the most and why. So do you have any books that you like to gift people and why do you like to gift those books?
I do. I like to gift people the 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, and I like to give people books on Enneagram. I really customize it to people, but in terms of the books that most influence my life, I really liked that part of the question. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings by Maya Angelou, and I felt like if Maya could go through the experiences that she had in her formative years and become the powerful, inspirational woman that she did become, that there was hope for me. And that gave me inspiration. Also, Rich Dad, The Cash Flow Quadrant.
Oh, okay.
Yes, by the author of Rich Dad, Poor Dad, Robert Kiyosaki. Mm-hmm. A friend gifted that book to me early in my college years and helped me to recognize how entrepreneurship could be a form of economic empowerment and social justice. And then lastly, the book that I referenced before, The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, A New Paradigm for Sustainable Success. And that book was actually gifted to me by the Kauffman Fellow Society when I was accepted as a finalist. So they brought all of the finalists and we had like a kickoff event and they gifted us with that. And the part of that book that stands out to me the most is the segment that talks about the stories we tell ourselves, right? Like if someone doesn't return an email and we think, well, maybe I said this wrong, or maybe they don't like me, or we make up all these stories without validation. And Brené Brown talks about that in some of her work as well. And that was really transformative for me. And I try to always be conscientious of when I'm telling myself stories about, you know, how I'm operating and interacting with other people in the world.
Those are fantastic. And that last one, just kind of stepping off that as well, you know, there are so many times when we reach out to somebody, we don't get a response for a week. And it could just be, hey, they're on a vacation, or, you know, they're completely bogged down. They're crappy at checking their email. And, you know, this is obviously just keeping it in the realm of emailing, for example, but perhaps you said hi to somebody, they just didn't notice you because they're working through their own life problems. And, you know, I think the mind is such a powerful thing that, you know, we get these emotions like rile us up and make us think that, hey, you know, we're doing something that is wrong here. But the reality is it has nothing to do with you. So I love that book. I'm going to have to honestly add every single one of those to my book list. That's exciting. I want to move the ball forward and I want to talk about something kind of fun. So imagine you had a gigantic billboard and you could put anything you wanted on it. It could be an image, it could be a metaphor, it could be whatever you wanted to be. And millions of people all around the world would see it and understand it, agnostic to what language it is in. What would you put on that billboard?
Well, the imagery, you know, I can imagine a million different images. So maybe this is going to have to be a billboard that has different images.
It folds out and opens up to more.
Yeah, it's going to have to be like a high-tech billboard. You know, maybe it'll be like a hologram billboard. Let's do that. Or one of those like new 3D ones. But what I would have it say, and this is something that is one of my rallying cries around the work that we do that you and I both have talked about, and that is diversity includes you.
Ooh. Oh, that hit deep. That hit so deep. I don't even want to make that any impure. I mean, that is so true. Wow. I can go on a whole tangent. I'm trying to hold myself back now.
We can unpack that.
I want to talk about that, but let's talk about that in part two. Let's keep the ball rolling.
Okay.
Diversity. Wow. That is amazing.
Diversity includes you.
That might have to be the name of this podcast. That is so fantastic. We'll circle back to that. I want to keep moving forward a little bit and talk about an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love. So something for me that's like an absurd thing that I love is I eat protein oatmeal every single morning for like, you know, the past like 6 months lately. So that might be kind of absurd to some people, but to me, it's something that keeps my body and health centered. Do you happen to have anything that might be seen as an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Yes, and I've got validation that people see it as absurd and unusual because I've been disclosing this. It comes up every now and then. I am on an oatmeal kick too, but that's another story. So my thing is, like many Black women, I have iron deficiency and yes. I take supplements and I will still be deficient, especially if there's any like stress or whatever, because stress impacts iron. Mm-hmm. So part of what happens with that is there's two things. One is pica, which is when you eat weird stuff. And I don't just eat a lot of weird stuff, but I'll get to that. And then the other thing is that we tend to be cold. So what's really, really strange about how my thing manifests, my absurd habit, is that my pica is ice. And so I chew ice, and because I don't want to ruin my teeth that I had all this orthodontic work on, I love soft ice. So think like Jamba Juice ice. I will literally go and get like a whole cup of Jamba Juice. My husband gives me bags
shaved ice
of Jamba Juice ice. Okay. So I love to chew ice, but then because I run cold, I like live with a heating pad for multiple reasons, but I have a heater right here by my side. I love chewing ice in the sun or by a heater, or, you know, sitting on my heating pad. So that's my little weird thing.
I love that. It keeps you nice and cool as well. So with that said, I want to talk about some other things that are from a larger time standpoint, right? So in the past 5 years, or even perhaps during COVID, you know, what beliefs, behaviors, or habits have most improved your life?
Well, you know, this goes back to the 15 commitments and the whole Kauffman experience. I was turned on to the Kauffman Fellow Society by someone I consider an advocate and sponsor, Rusty Dornan. She was a former CNN correspondent. And so the Kauffman Fellow Society.
And for our listeners that don't know what the Kauffman is.
Yes. So the Kauffman Fellow Society is like the next generation of venture capitalists. There, it's a global network. It's very entrepreneur friendly. And so by virtue of my involvement in Kauffman Fellows Academy courses, like venture deals and startup CEO, I met Rusty Dornan and I told her, you know, I'm really interested in venture capital at large. I've always been interested in capital formation. The startup that I was going through these classes with had to do with capital formation for the entertainment industry. But I told her I really am interested in venture capital at large. And she encouraged me to apply. So when I did, going back to that orientation where they gave us the book, The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, they really underscore the importance of establishing ourselves through thought leadership. And I had been like, you know, blogging a little bit here and there and, you know, opining, you know, within different forums, but I really decided to lean into that. And my husband had also been encouraging me. I mean, we did different mentorship things, but he'd really been pushing me to be more vocal and public facing, which I've kind of shied away from. I'm comfortable being behind the scenes, but it really propelled me to really lean into that. And what I've learned over these past several years is that my thought leadership matters. You know, my opinions matter. My life experiences, my lived experiences and my education, they matter in this realm, particularly in what is considered a very left brain field, a very technical field of, you know, technology, entrepreneurship, rational, venture capital, but it's not. There's nothing about the human experience that is not left brain, right brain. And we really have to integrate both. And a lot of times we're so focused on the technical side that we don't bring in that critical thinking and the intersections of humanity and the context of our history, et cetera. So, you know, when I'm opining on, like, say, the diversity issue that nobody wanted to talk about 5 years ago, even though there was a lot of hostility and toxicity back then, I've persevered through that. And I've learned that it really matters and it makes an impact and the people listen. Even though I don't have, like, I'm not this big famous influencer, I have a circle of influential people in influential places. Mm-hmm. And so that thought leadership, it really does matter.
That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, to be frank with you, you know, I'm working in the diversity space as well. And you realize that, sure, there might be some content that's getting pushed out by these larger companies, but to have a face and a name to put to things, right? You know, I don't want to be too drastic, but, you know, if we look at George Floyd, his face means something now, right? It's a representation of systemic issues, right? People like you and I talking about these things, and putting our faces on this and sharing our experience, it means something. It makes it personal and it makes it human. And that's, I think, that connection to thought leadership and pioneering a space or a discussion is hugely impactful. I love that. That's really amazing.
Absolutely.
Now, I want to move the ball forward and I want to talk about kind of the defining moments of when you decide to go down a certain route in life. You know, you said that you had this immense interest in capital formation, as well as, you know, just being in the venture capital space and the impact that you can have. For you, was there a defining moment or a series of events that occurred that made you say to yourself, this is where I want to be, this is the type of work I want to do?
There were many defining moments for me individually that led to where I am. Mark Suster is one of my favorite VCs to follow. I love his blog, Both Sides of the Table. And he has this blog called Lines Not Dots. And the context of that is really about like tracking entrepreneurs and not just evaluating them based on one data point, but over time. But it's kind of like the same in life, right? There's been things at different points of my life that have brought me to where I am today. So, you know, from, you know, growing up as a mixed chick, you know, like we were talking about, we both have, you know, multi-ethnic backgrounds, right? And so some of those lived experiences made me curious, like, why is somebody saying they would never date me because I'm Black? Not that I'm interested in dating that person in the first place,
oh,
but like, what compelled you to even say that? You know, like I would go home sometimes, I'd look in the mirror, I'd be like, okay, so maybe I'm not the finest person ever, but you know, I don't think I'm ugly. Why do people tell me I'm ugly? Or why are they making fun of this feature or that feature? Or, you know, what's wrong with the color of my skin? Like, I don't think there's something wrong with it. You know, I'd sit out in the sun and bake with my mom with the oil, and my mom was Caucasian or white, whatever you call it. But, you know, those experiences gave me a curiosity that led to me becoming an ethnic studies and Pan-African studies minor, right? Or to looking into the representations of people of color in the media. And then when I was exposed to Cashflow Quadrant, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, and layered that entrepreneurial side of it, while I was in the midst of the tech boom going on in Silicon Valley, while I was an undergrad at UC Berkeley, all of those things combined to give me my unique perspective and purpose in the world. So it was that, it was the mentors and role models that came into my life at the right time, who opened doors, who saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. You know, just, and then now I think this is a defining moment collectively, right? Where I've been doing this work for many years to contribute to the technology industry when it comes to diversity. In fact, you know, 20 years ago, I'm dating myself, you know, I was there when Jesse Jackson was talking about bridging the digital divide. Yeah. And then here we are, fast forward, you know, over a decade, he's calling for the diversity numbers from big tech companies. And now we fast forward again, we're coming almost like to another full circle moment, but this time people are saying, oh yeah, Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. You know, now people experience a little slice of the trauma that is manifested in George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and, you know, others that we've seen, and we're kind of like a captive audience. So I think that the culmination of my life's work leading up till now, this is a defining moment where I feel like it's being validated.
Mm-hmm. And there's something about delayed gratification. When you're doing all this work and you start to see it come through, and it becomes, it's like a humble appreciation for the work that you're doing, because you can see it does have an impact. And it's really interesting that you mentioned, you know, all these people saw something around you that you do not see in yourself. I think that's really interesting. I just want to pull that out because, you know, you hear the saying, you know, you're the average of the six people you spend the most time around, you know, you need to have mentors to help bridge gaps for certain skill sets or certain relationships that you need in life. And, you know, it's so important to have people that are, and you know, it's interesting. We had a discussion, I forgot it was with Adobe or McKinsey yesterday. And we were talking about the difference between having a sponsor and having a, you know, a peer or like a manager, right? Because the key difference is that, you know, these people might like you, but they're not willing to put their reputation, their brand, their name on the line to say, no, you need to get this person, you need to get Mariah, you need to get Alec into this program, into this company. You know, you need to maximize their potential because they have so much that they can offer to X, Y, and Z, right? Insert whatever you want there. And, you know, I think that's so important to call it to that because of these people willing to be, you know, truly your sponsor and push you forward. It's helped you become the person you are today. So that's a really amazing story, Mariah. I really love that.
Yeah, and some of it was my friend giving me the book. Like, I don't know what you're going to do with this information, but he saw something in me where he knew that this was going to have an impact and that I would use it for the greatest good. Mm-hmm. He knew that about me. He knew I wasn't just going to use it for myself, right? Mm-hmm. Because I'm just naturally, I share information, you know, I'm just that kind of person. I learned something, I want to share it with everybody else. Like, I got this aha, here, let me accelerate you through this process by, you know, imparting it into you. So there was just that, like, you know, I see something in you, but then going back to like Rusty Dornan, when she encouraged me to apply as a Kauffman Fellow, you know, there's this guy that was in the Kauffman Fellows Academy. He was our TA. And I kept in touch with him. And he told me one day, he was like, Mariah, I don't know what you did to Rusty, but she's always talking about you, because he worked there at the Kauffman Fellows Society. She's like, have you looked at Mariah's application? Don't forget about Mariah. Like, she always would bring my name up, and she did advocate for me. She was a sponsor. And so I know that she was influential. And even though I didn't become a Kauffman Fellow, because it was like $100,000 for 2 years, and, you know, I didn't get sponsored in, I mean, maybe that we'll dip more into that, but, you know, it still got my toe in the door and allowed me to start getting to know people in that space. And some people who actually were fellows, they ended up, you know, introducing me to other people and opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so her sponsorship in that regard still did open up doors for me.
I think that kind of reminds me of like water running down a mountain, right? It might start at one point, and then these deep valleys get built, and these different ravines and different runoffs start to occur. And I look at that a lot like the relationships we make. It might start with one person, might connect it to another individual who may come up down the road, or you might run into them at an event or over whatever, you know, common thing that you find yourself in. And that relationship then compounds and gets you connected to the right people and can push you forward. And also just the little things, right? As you're saying, it could just be a book. It could just be something simple that you take and you use and you manifest whatever you take from that item or that thing, and you push it into the world and create more opportunity. Now, I want to keep moving the ball forward here. I got two more questions for you, and I want to talk about failures. So I fail all the time, right? I have this notepad. I keep a list of things I got to do every day. And for some reason, I can never cross out every single thing. I tell myself it's because I'm being ambitious, but hey, maybe it's bad time management skills. It could be whatever, right? For you, do you happen to have a failure or even an apparent failure that ended up setting you up for success down the road? And if there's not one that ended up setting you up for success down the road that you want to talk about, perhaps do you have a favorite failure that taught you an important lesson that you could briefly go over?
I have no favorite failures. Plenty of failures, but none are favorites. But, you know, I'm like you, there's 24 hours in a day, and that goes back to like the stories we tell ourselves, right?
It goes quick.
You know, fall below the fold, or, you know, it's like this week I have to prioritize that. You know, it's rarely ever a personal thing. You were only human, and that entails failure. I've heard it said that if you're not failing, you're not taking enough risk, right? So I've had so many failures, but I think there's been things that could be perceived as failures that were more significant than others that did set me up. Mm-hmm. And for example, just because we touched on this already, you know, the Kauffman Fellows experience, like there was a couple of things that factored into this, but, you know, I had this opportunity, I applied, was selected as a finalist, but then I had to basically, you know, interview, you know, go and like network and hustle to meet VCs and try to convince someone to hire me and sponsor my fellowship, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at the time, I'm here in Sacramento. The heuristic was you must live in Silicon Valley or else you're like nobody, because Silicon Valley is Mecca. And I'm like from there, but come on, like we have a whole nation with millions of people. Like not everyone can fit in the Valley, right? It's like when network effects come.
And also there's this thing called Zoom now and like all these other tools that make it super easy.
Right. But back then, before the pandemic, like, come on. So I was like driving,
yeah, face-to-face.
I was driving to Silicon Valley and I was stacking meetings all day long. And I'm also a mom, you know, oof. And there's all this, you know, bias against like what we can do as women, what we can do as moms, you know, just like walking in the room, not pattern matching. There's like all of this, right? But then I've also been in a car accident. And so like even driving for me, like I used to drive every day back and forth to the Bay when I was in the financial industry, just doing like meetings, right? But, you know, after this car accident, like driving 3 hours, like I need some recovery. I need some therapy. I need acupuncture and stuff. So, you know, for a multitude of reasons. And then the feedback that I was getting was like, she's too vocal about diversity. You know, she should go work for a diversity organization. Like the Sand Hill Road people, they just weren't ready. It was a different time. We hadn't done the work, right? But, you know, I'm thankful now because I had the objective of going in as like an entrepreneur in residence or, you know, some entry level position within a VC firm, you know, establishing a track record and spinning out into my own firm. That was part of the 5-year plan, right? But what I realized was, okay, I'm going to have to develop my own track record. And I thought I was going to do it through a certain path and strategy. But after, and I always give credit to these folks because they were also transformative in my life, Catherine Finney came out with Project Diane, which was the first in-depth study of how Black women specifically were faring in venture capital. And at that time, and it's increased, I think it's in the 90s now or more, but at the time, only 13 Black women had raised over $1 million in venture capital. We still know that less than 1% of venture capital goes to people of color. So women, especially Black women, are a small sliver of that. And even though I've never been like solely focused on, you know, I only want to invest in women or I only want to invest in people of color, you know, that impacted me personally as a woman of color. And I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't even aware of what I was up against, right? Because you think that Martin Luther King died and your mom's generation burned their bra so that you don't have to deal with sexism and you know, racism and bias, et cetera. But then here comes the Me Too movement. It's like, oh, okay, I'm not the only one. 40% of women are experiencing this. Mm-hmm. So I say all that to say that, you know, I realized I'm going to have to develop my own track record. And then ultimately I realized, okay, even in going out and launching my own firm, Diversity Ventures, there's these barriers to entry that are systemic, right? It's not about whether I can win good deals and add value and create alpha. You know, there's considerations that have to do with like track record. Well, if I can't get into a firm to spin out of a firm because of bias,
how am I going to build a track record?
How do you expect me to have an attributable track record?
That's 22.
If I'm not getting hired equitably into a tech company so that I can be on that cap table and get my exit shares, you know, have my golden handcuffs, then maybe I'm not going to be able to angel invest. If there's a funding gap, if there's a wealth and a wage gap, maybe I'm not going to be able to equitably angel invest. If there's SEC regulations that dictate whether or not I'm an accredited investor and can get into a Reg D 506 offering, 506C offering, then, you know, how am I going to establish that track record? I'm not going to have the same opportunity as my, say, white male privileged counterpart that comes from the 15% of Americans that are accredited investors by these systemic barriers, right? And so looking at today, I was sitting in on an SEC conversation. And they're talking about these institutional barriers. They're talking about track record. They're talking about accountability and transparency. And guess what? Last year, I was able to take advantage to become an Aspen Tech Policy Hub Fellow and start doing the deep dive, getting to the root of these systemic barriers. And if I were not unbossed and unbought by virtue of being the founding partner of Diversity Ventures, then I wouldn't have the liberty to do that because I would be pressured to conform to the environment of Sand Hill Road, right? I've heard VC say that work in existing firms that, you know, they didn't want to rock the boat. They worked hard to get into their position. They're the one and only in the room, right?
Sponsor versus peer.
You see this even with, the research that Harvard has done around, like they had pitches by male and female founders, the exact same pitch.
And like the investment percentage was different.
They were perceived different regardless of whether it was a male or female evaluating them. Mm-hmm. And so that shows that, you know, the women are also conforming, right? Because they don't want to be like, they don't want to be the one that's a social justice warrior, which I've been called, right? And I've even blogged about that, you know? And so I feel like that failure to convert over actually put me in position to have a greater impact. And, you know, I'm not one to ever believe that I've arrived, but I feel like it's part of my journey and my purpose. And so I'm thankful that it directed me in another way.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's really powerful because pulling out a couple of things. One that stood out to me was talking about being an accredited investor, right? The barrier to entry is millions of dollars in assets, right? And if you come from a background that's economically disadvantaged historically, that means you have to take the time to build up that economic status, save that money up before you can even get into a certain area. It's basically like saying, it's like telling a kid who's eventually going to be 6 feet tall, but they're 5'6 right now and they're, you know, 15 years old, they have a couple of years to grow. You can't join us until you're 6 feet, but after a couple of years, they're able to build themselves up. And then when they finally get there, then they can enter. But the person they were didn't really change or anything like that. The value that they could bring to the table didn't necessarily change. It's just a certain set of criteria, which were fundamentally
flawed.
Yes, I think I would put it that way. Fundamentally flawed, led to having to take a nonlinear path. This is something I talk about a lot with product manager Mark Valoria. Shout out Mark Valoria, a mentor as well. We talk about the nonlinear career path because so many people think that you do step one, step two, step three, step four, and then you get to step five. But more so, it's like you do A, D, E, J, then you get B, and you finally come back before you make it to where you need to be because there are so many different hurdles and systems at play. So I really love what you're saying there. Now, I want to round this out and talk a little bit about being overwhelmed and not being able to stay focused all the time. We have millions of things going on. Some days, honestly, I'm burnt out. And I need to go on a walk, go on a run, and I just need to reset. I didn't get enough hours to sleep this night because I was doing X, Y, and Z, or I was working until a late hour. Then I wanted to just read a book, and then I realized, oh man, it's 1 a.m, 2 a.m, and I got to wake up early in the morning, right? So many ways we can get overwhelmed that then lead into being unfocused throughout the day. For you, what do you do to get your focus back, get that energy back? And, you know, are you asking yourself questions? Could you let us in on that?
Oh, absolutely. And I love this question because especially now, and especially as a Black woman, because it's come up in all these conversations in this past year, following George Floyd, particularly, you know, this aspect of self-care and the fact that we have to work twice as hard, you know, to get half of the results. And that's probably an understatement, right?
That's a common saying, listeners, by the way, for the Black community, work twice as hard to get half as much.
Exactly. And we're asked, you know, I saw a post by Arlen Hamilton, I think maybe it was last night, and she was talking about how, like, you know, we've been subject to this trauma and then we're being asked to teach the class so that the people who are like tuned into our trauma, like, oh, help me to deal with your trauma. You know what I mean? And so we've all been asked to do all these talks and do all these things. And we want to be part of the change because it impacts us. We don't have a choice to opt out of it. We're not, you know, privileged to opt out of it. And so we're like,
but you also don't want to be the token as well, right? The token Black person. So you want to try to find that happy mix, which is a very hard delineation.
And this is a whole subject in and of itself. Like I had to mute.
I don't think we're making it out of this fire round today.
I had to mute the comments on a LinkedIn post around someone crossing out the female in front of founder and saying that it belittles her to have that. And I'm like, look, call me a female, call me a Black woman, and recognize the value that I bring to the table. Recognize the experience that I bring to the table. I am not going to diminish everything that I've had to go through as a Black woman to be at this table, to be in this realm, to still be here despite every single barrier, every single aggression, micro or macro or otherwise. No, let it be known. Yes, I am a Black woman. I am proud. That does not mean that I'm any less. It doesn't mean that anyone gave me any leg up or any kind of thing, advantage. Like, please let it be known. And we can have that deeper discussion if you want to have it. But yes, I am a Black woman. I'm a Black woman founder. It is just two of the things that describe me. So yeah, going back to being like the overwhelmed, like that is such a big thing because we do have to work so much harder. So yes, I have felt burnout and plus I'm an INFJ and we do, that's one of our weaknesses is that we burn our candle at both ends. So fortunately, self-awareness is part of it, right? Being self-aware that, hey, this can be a weakness. So when I'm doing too much or for much, I need to prioritize self-care so that I can continue to do the work. And if someone's disappointed, then, hey, honey, look, I'm sorry that you don't understand that I need to take care of me. but that's not my problem right now, you know? Mm-hmm. So if I want to have the biggest impact, then I need to take care of me. And so that involves doing a dip into right brain activities, meditating, going into nature. I like to sit in the sun, listen to the birds. I like to dance. I do dance parties with my daughter. You know, I put on some like gospel rap or some little jammy jam, some old school. You know, sometimes it'll be a little Tupac or something.
Some Nicole Bus.
You know, like, you know, I'll color with my daughter or draw. I like to watch movies, which I think are, you know, storytelling is so important to building empathy, but it also allows us to escape and get out of our own reality. And so those are just some of the things that I do to help like reset and recalibrate so that I can go back out and do the work.
I love that. And I think one of the key pieces there is, you know, you take the time to do it, right? I think that when I was talking at the very beginning of this question, I said, hey, you know, I might be reading late at night or something, but that's me taking the time to separate my brain to do something else so that I feel mentally like I'm not honestly just a slave to work all the time.
Exactly.
I think that's an accurate way to depict that. So that's so fantastic.
And there's a braggadocio also, especially in our industry around
working hard,
that hustle,
all the time.
Right? The overwork. But it's like, okay, how long are we supposed to do that? And am I supposed to get cancer and stress-related diseases and die so that I can get your social approval and validation? Like, no.
I'm totally with it. With that said, I want to take a deeper dive on your background, and we're going to hop into part two. Listeners, thank you so much for checking out part one with Mariah Lichtenstern. Now we're going to take a little bit more of a different route. We're going to talk about diversity, her background, and some of the discussions that we've already been having. Tune in for part two. See you there.